This session and the one tomorrow, it's sort of a two-part mini-series, really extend out of my own experience.
Where did you do your practice?
Good question. At the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. No, in Seattle. Yeah. Just to kind of plug the session tomorrow, that will, I think, be more a sharing of perspectives and experiences that all of us have had, and some of my perceptions on how this AIDS epidemic is actually changing our society, and to some extent changing the church as well, primarily for the better, but given the nature of the beast that we're talking about, also a bit for the worst. And I hope that those of you who decide to return will bring your experiences to that one. I think that session will be intrinsically a little bit more participatory. Today's session, concentrating more about medical aspects and biological aspects of the virus, I fear I have a bit of talking to do. But I hope that you will feel free to chime in with experiences or questions or comments as you feel appropriate, because I welcome those. And I'll try not to give too much of a biological monologue here. Today's session really comes out of a question that I'm often asked when acquaintances find out that I'm a researcher in the area of HIV. And that question, most pointedly put, is usually, when are we going to have a cure? Or actually, sometimes even more pointed than that, why don't we have a cure yet? And of course, at the end of a long bad day, perhaps my first response would be defensive. Well, you know, this disease was first discovered or noticed essentially in early 1981. It's been around only about 11 years, and we already know more about this virus than we really know about any other viruses that infect or plague human beings. So my defensive response is, well, we've already made a fair amount of progress. But I think that it really is a legitimate question, and it does, I think, offer us the opportunity to explore how far we've come and what we know and what we already have to offer individuals infected with HIV. And then in addition, why, what the problems are and in what ways this virus is a bit tricky, why it's tripping us up, and why we really haven't found a cure yet, given the immense amount of effort that's already been put into exploring the disease and its biology. I think first, though, it'd be helpful for me to know what you folks know or what your experiences with this have been. How many of you have had a friend or a family member, let's say, a close friend or family member with HIV or with AIDS? Okay. Thanks. How many of you, in addition, perhaps know someone or have had some acquaintanceship with someone who is HIV infected? Alrighty. Thanks.
About AIDS.
Yeah, AIDS or yeah. HIV infected, yeah. Right. Yeah. And is there anybody who works or volunteers in the area? I guess I know that you volunteer in the area. Anybody else that is doing that? Or okay, well, that's great.
We're just after information.
Okay, well, you're going to get it. I think we're going to start off with a little bit of a pop quiz, just to kind of help me cover some of the basic nomenclature, and then we'll go on to some other things that I suspect that probably, unless you're actually a researcher or a doctor in this field, that you don't know. Who can tell me what HIV stands for? What are the... Right, yeah, human immunodeficiency virus. Actually, maybe I should scratch that up here. One of the reasons why I wrote a little glossary up here is because I'm not very good at writing these things in short order. Virus. Okay, there's a couple features of this name that I think are worth knowing. One is that HIV, the virus, is related to a number of other viruses that are found in nature in various other animals, both birds and mammals. And so it's important to realize that this is, you know, a human virus, but it has relatives, it has analogs. The second is that its primary activity is it depresses the immune system. And we will cover, or we'll get into that a little bit later, but it depresses the immune system in a fairly specific way. And finally, of course, it's a virus, which means that it's not a bacterium. It can't be treated with antibiotics. And antibiotics have been around now for about four decades or five decades, but our knowledge of viruses is still in a relative infancy compared to what we know about bacteria and their treatment and their life cycle. What does AIDS stand for? Anybody?
Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome.
Right. The acquired part is important. This is obviously something that, you know, that is superimposed on a previously healthy immune system. I guess the one exception to that is when babies are actually born with it. You know, it's hard to, at some point in the womb, they had a normal immune system for their fetal development. But in all adults, anyway, it's acquired. It's immunodeficiency for the same reason that word, that I is in the HIV. It's a disease, and I think it's important to realize that it's a syndrome as well. AIDS is a cluster of infections. Any one person may not have all of them or may not have all of the constellations of the syndrome. AIDS is defined by individuals who have the HIV virus, but in addition have developed one or more opportunistic infections or tumors. One or more infections or tumors that ordinarily the immune system, if it's healthy, keeps in check. Most of the infections that AIDS patients get are infections of organisms that, for the most part, many of us carry with us, are part of sort of our normal daily microbial flora, the critters that we sort of have tucked away in the nooks and crannies of our bodies. About 60% of AIDS patients, at least it used to be this way a few years ago, developed a type of pneumonia called pneumocystis pneumonia. Pneumocystis is a bug, it's actually a protozoan, which is a category of bug, that most of us encounter when we're young children. By the time that we're 5 or 10, almost all of us have already seen pneumocystis. Hasn't caused us any difficulty whatsoever. But when the certain part of the immune system that HIV attacks gets sufficiently depressed, the immune system can no longer keep that bug in check, keep it in its normal place in our body. And it develops a full-blown pneumonia, and we have one of the infections that cause AIDS. Other similar sort of bugs that oftentimes that most of us carry in some way or have seen at some time include toxoplasmosis, cryptosporidium, a sort of a whole grab bag of long terms, medical leads, sort of Latinate terms that ordinarily you hear nothing about because they're not infections that plague people with healthy immune systems. How many people, or what percentage of individuals infected with the virus go on to AIDS? Anybody have a crack, have a guess at that? Is it everybody?
No.
Yeah.
60?
Yeah, hey, that's great. I'm impressed, that's great. The information that we have, it needs to be taken a little bit carefully because almost all of the studies available come from this country and therefore come mostly from the population of gay males. But in that population, the best evidence that we have, now that this epidemic has gone on for almost 12 years, is that at, let's say, 12 years, only about somewhere between 40% and 60% of individuals who have HIV actually have gone on to AIDS by now, which means that there may be some individuals that are able to, for the most part, resist the effects, the immune-suppressing effects of the virus for a goodly period of time. Perhaps, you know, some of those individuals may go on for another few decades without getting AIDS at all. Once somebody has gotten AIDS, the best information that we have is that it really is pretty much a uniformly fatal condition to have. However, even AIDS patients can live for a prolonged period of time. Some of them can continue if their original opportunistic superimposed infection was effectively treated, some of them can continue to live for quite a period of time. I have had patients that are still living at somewhere between 5 and 7 years after their initial diagnosis of AIDS. So to have HIV isn't synonymous with having AIDS. However, to have AIDS, you have to have been infected with HIV. Parenthetically, it should be said that there is an occasional researcher in a million out there, a medical researcher, who's still disputing whether the virus is the cause of AIDS. But I think pretty much all of us consider that to be sort of a crackpot theory that it would not be. And almost all medical researchers these days consider HIV to be the primary cause of AIDS. Let's see here. Who has HIV? Just some basic epidemiologic statistics, some description of the epidemic that I wanted to provide for you. There's sort of two ways to look at this, and one of them is the worldwide perspective. The numbers that we have come from estimates from the World Health Organization, and their best estimate is that about 12 million individuals worldwide now are infected with HIV, which is a tremendous number, but even more tremendous is their projection that by the year 2000, roughly 8, maybe 10 years from now, there will be 40 million individuals infected with the virus. And in addition, I think it's interesting to note, and it's extremely sobering to note, that WHO also expects there to be about 5 million children who are orphans of HIV-infected patients by the year 2000, a staggering problem. In the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, which is the repository for these kinds of numbers, estimates that there are probably now more than 1 million people who have been infected with the HIV virus, and there's probably about 250,000, or about a quarter of those infected in this country, who have clearly developed full-blown AIDS. The one thing I think to point out about that is that in the grand scheme of things, although the United States was one of the first countries to have a major problem with HIV, we now have only about a 12th of the individuals infected in the world. And about half of the individuals infected in the world now reside in Africa, primarily sub-Saharan Africa. Another thing to note is that in this country, although we still have a major problem, the plague has been, the epidemic has been said to be sort of leveling out, in the sense that approximately the same number of individuals now are dying every year as are getting reinfected. Still, obviously, something that we have major amounts of work to do, but now about perhaps 50,000 individuals a year are acquiring the infection, and roughly that many are also succumbing to it. Just a quick review of what the risk factors are, or how HIV was acquired. I guess I could form this as a quiz, but since I've already got it up here, that's probably not the best way to go. I needed to put it up here because I have to get these sort of things out on the board, for starters. As you probably know, sexual transmission is the primary route of transmission of the virus. In this country, the primary risk group for that has been gay or bisexual males, and about 2/3 of adults in this country have acquired their infection through that form of sexual activity. However, a growing percentage of individuals in this country are acquiring it through heterosexual transmission. Roughly 2 years ago or so, or 3 years ago, this number as the percentage of total adults infected in this country was about 4%. Now it's 6%. And we are on the cusp, or perhaps some would say deeply into already, the second wave of the epidemic in this country, which in cities like New York and Philadelphia and Florida and Los Angeles, looks much more like the infection that's being seen in developing countries, primarily heterosexual, than it does like the infection that's seen in that was seen in the United States during the 80s. The other primary route in this country of acquiring it is through intravenous needles, primarily needles shared between intravenous drug users, which highlights, I think, that this is an infection that involves blood contamination. And then there are two other routes that are important. Increasingly important is the route of mothers passing it on to babies. About 30% of babies born to HIV-infected mothers have the virus. And finally, about 3% of individuals in this country acquired theirs through blood transfusion, although since 1985, that is now an extremely rare and basically a non-existent problem in this country. However, it's still a major problem in other parts of the world where they do not have the capacity, the financial resources to test their blood supply or to clean their transfusion needles and other equipment. Worldwide, I think it's important to notice that four times as many individuals have been infected through heterosexual sex as have through gay sex. So looking at it from a worldwide perspective, this is a disease of heterosexual activity.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
There's some, rumors or whatever, myth about blood to blood, okay, open source. And I heard about a young man who was a youth worker who was who befriended a young man in their church who had AIDS, and they, went on an outing or something together. AIDS person, hurt himself and vanished his legs and threw a cut in his wound, got AIDS and died. This, heterosexual man. Someone recently told me that you have to have really quite a bit of exposure, blood to blood. What do you know about that?
Well, it's true that this is a virus that circulates in the system, in the blood system, in relatively small quantities. And so it's true that you need a fairly large amount of blood to have much of a risk of acquiring the infection. Now, there is the extremely rare and oddball case of someone who's only had a tiny amount of exposure to an infected person's blood, but your risk is of that happening is quite small, very, very small, as opposed to generally the risk that's considered, the amount of blood that's required is amount that's in a fairly wide bore needle, and taking up a fairly good chunk of that needle diameter, and so usually it takes a good penetration with a fairly large inoculum of blood to get transmission. But it's possible that person could have been infected. There's such a thing as relatively rare bad luck. So
okay,
yeah.
I was just curious.
Is the same thing true? Ask it this way. In professional basketball, any player who gets a scar has to immediately go out of the game with those covered. Is that really that kind of a risk?
I think it's a little silly, truthfully, but I think they have to do certain things for sort of legal and protection that maybe don't make a whole lot of medical sense.
Is that going to happen in professional football too, where there's a lot more?
Well, I think professional football, there's a fair amount more blood flying around, and probably it's more likely that not only the individual who's infected, but also the individual who is not infected, may both have fairly good sized wounds going on at any point. My apologies to those of you who are football fans, but I think that I would, given that football is a little bit more of a bloody sport, I do not think it's imprudent to be cautious in that, particularly if people are getting sprayed with blood in the area of their mouth where they may already have some significant, bleeding sores. I have an exaggerated sense of how bloody a sport football is, but as a physician, I'm not sure that's unwarranted. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What is the rate of transmission now to healthcare workers who have a stick from an HIV individual?
It's very low. It's well less than 0.3%, essentially. It depends part on what size of an inoculum received, what size, what, how you were exposed. You know, was it a needle that had been full of blood? Was there a syringe attached to it that had been full of blood? But for those who have simply been splashed with somebody else's blood on their intact skin or their intact mucous membranes, or for those who have been stuck with a needle that probably, you know, had really nothing in it or very little in it, the risk of actually being infected with the virus is very, very small.
Yeah, 0.3% of exposures.
0.3%, less than 0.3% of exposures.
How long does it take, or what is the incubation period for the time one might become exposed?
Good question. The virus probably sets up shop relatively quickly, but the way that we test for the virus is through an antibody test. That is to say, the body has to not only have the virus, but also to respond to it in a way that we can detect. We're detecting a chemical that the body makes in response to the virus, not the virus itself, at least in the screening test that we do. And so because of that, that response can sometimes take a period of 3 to 6 months. So usually we say that there's a window of exposure of 3 to 6 months between when somebody actually was exposed, and it may be as long as 6 months before their antibody test turns positive. More commonly, however, people have usually turned positive within 1 to 2 months. So that's the period of time when we follow, for example, a healthcare worker with a potential exposure most aggressively.
Does anyone give credence to the suggestion that the African epidemic started with infected smallpox virus?
The more common, there's two theories of that sort. One is the smallpox one. The one that I think is given a little more credence is the suggestion that it was polio virus that was involved. I think probably it's best to say that that's a highly controversial and debated question among scientists, and one of the problems with it is, since it's sort of a historical question, it may be difficult to answer definitively. I think the more likely explanation of where this virus came from is that it came as a mutation of a animal immunodeficiency, some other animal, probably monkeys, virus that was incubating in a rural area for probably decades in some small corner of the world, and then somehow in the 1970s it managed to sort of break out of its remote location and you know, enter larger urban areas. And at that point, any infection that that is not adequately checked by immune systems or by, you know, medical technology in this day and age, where we have such broad transportation possibilities, is going to spread around the globe very quickly, and that's what's happened. So some people actually, through computer modeling, have suggested that the virus may have been present in some small isolated human population for as long as perhaps 100 years before it finally broke out in the 1970s. So, you know, you kind of take the theory that you prefer, and yours is as good as mine to some degree, but that's the one that I prefer the most. I think it sort of fits with the history of epidemics of other types in general. So those are great questions. Anybody else got another one before we move on to biology? I think I wanted to say that, you know, these statistics and the ones about how many individuals are infected are staggering. And it's important to realize, I think, or it's important for me to remember, as someone has said, that statistics are people with the tears washed off. I can give you just one sort of person who I've come to know. One of my patients, whose name is Mike, I think he grew up in Nebraska. I can't remember truthfully which town. Grew up in a Methodist family, loving parents. Was a good student in school, was by his own admission fairly bookish and somewhat of a nerd and a little bit shy, but managed through his scholastic competence to get a partial scholarship to a school on the West Coast, to a college, And during his later high school years and his early college years, started to experience some confusion about his sexual identity, had some experience, some gay sexual encounters, partly through self-esteem difficulties associated with that, and through what happens at colleges these days, found alcohol, managed to get through college and did quite well, and start on the first year of a secondary school teaching career, but developed alcohol, or his alcoholism became a barrier to that, and spent the next 4 or 5 years grappling through treatment with his alcoholism and grappling with his sexual identity. Through, as he tells it, really, you know, ultimately the loving support of his parents and his sister, and a lot of counseling, he managed to come to terms both with his alcoholism and sort of get that under control, and also with his gay sexuality. Moved to Seattle, was in the first year of a renewed career as a secondary school teacher, and then developed one of these opportunistic infections, and you know, had a test for HIV and turned positive, at which time he appeared in my clinic. And at that point, you know, the question to me always is, what can I offer individuals like this? What sort of hope do I have to provide them? And I think truthfully that's what the point of discussing the biology is, because I think now we do have some hope to offer, and some possibility to offer. We also have obviously some frustrations and problems. The first aspect of biology that I want to talk about is the fact that stems from the fact that HIV is a retrovirus. In field biology, for example, you know, we all know that we can differentiate mammals on the basis of certain characteristics. You know, we have the dogs, you have your cats, you have your horses, you know, your family groupings. And you and I all can, probably you better than I, because I'm not much of a field biologist, can provide the physical characteristics that allow us to differentiate those animals and put them into a, you know, relationship tree, a biological relationship tree. Well, it's the same for viruses, except the way that we do that differentiation for viruses is on the basis of their chemical and genetic structure, what their chemical capacities are. And retroviruses, of which HIV is, or the two HIVs, there's actually two HIV viruses, what called 1 and 2. The two HIVs are really the only retroviruses that infect or humans, and they're, or, well, that's not altogether true, that cause a major problem in humans, let's put it that way. And all retroviruses, including HIV, have a unique property of containing an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. Ordinarily, in all other life forms, all human cells, all cells of any type, all other viruses for the most part, the flow of biological information is from the genes, which are composed of DNA, to smaller molecules, which are called RNA, generally sort of colloquially referred to, or for short referred to as the message or the messengers. Smaller molecules that are copied from DNA by a host of enzymes in our cells that provide shorter messages made in a one-to-one correspondence method directly from the DNA. And then finally, the RNA is used as a template to build proteins, which are the worker bees of the cells or of any biological system. Retroviruses are unique in that they can actually add, they are RNA-containing viruses, and they have an enzyme right here that can actually transform RNA to DNA. Rather than the usual forward route of DNA to RNA to proteins, retroviruses can actually go reverse, retro, from RNA to DNA. So here's where reverse transcriptase does its thing. So the, this is, when this property of HIV was realized in about 83 or so, it was clearly evident that this was a very, this property of retroviruses is highly unique, and it was a potential target for drug therapy. And subsequently, there have been several drugs developed, and others are coming, that interfere with reverse transcriptase's ability to turn the viral RNA into DNA, and therefore its ability to go through the rest of the life cycle, make new proteins and new virus particles, and replicate itself. Drugs that, and some of these I'm sure you've heard about, that so far are out are AZT, which was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 87, has been used in hundreds of thousands of HIV-infected individuals in this country so far and in other Western countries. Subsequently, in the last year, we've had two more, DDI, which was approved by the FDA in October of 91, and DDC, which was finally approved in early June or so, about 3 months or maybe 2 months ago. I can't remember the exact date, but subsequently I have several patients on it. So this is really the standard armamentarium that we have to offer to slow down the virus in HIV-infected individuals. And to a person, pretty much every one of the patients in my clinic are on one, if not more than one, of these drugs. There are some others that are coming along. D4T, which is being tried in large human trials now in this country, including a small one that's going in Seattle and a pretty large one that's going in Vancouver, British Columbia, for those of you that are from the Pacific Northwest. And an even more potent drug, we hope, that's coming down the pike, that's actually going to get its first trial in this country in Seattle this winter, if we're on target, called PMEA. These letter and number abbreviations are abbreviations of long chemical names, which I think are so difficult that none of us remember them, or at least few of us. And so I think it's easier just to refer to them by their short names. The problem with all... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are they going to be as expensive as AZT?
Yeah, well, that's a good question as well. perhaps, yeah. There's a number of problems with these drugs. The two major problems from a biological standpoint is that, one, at least the drugs that we have available, and for sure D4T as well, do not completely shut down the virus's capacity to replicate and to go through its life cycle. They help a lot. AZT, which is the one that we have the most experience with now, clearly prolongs the time between getting the virus and getting AIDS on the average by perhaps a year to a year and a half. We are pretty sure that it prolongs people's lives by at least a period of time. Certainly it prolongs their healthy time. And it has some other salubrious immune function effects. But they're not perfect drugs, and people progress. The other difficulty that we have with these is that after someone's been on them for a period of a couple years or so, somewhere longer than a year, they start to seem to develop some tolerance to it. And there are probably several reasons for that. One of the reasons is that reverse transcriptase, one of the reasons is that the virus can mutate to change its capacity to be affected by these drugs. Just the biological reason for that is that ordinarily in most life forms, this process of transcribing, it's called, of turning DNA into RNA is a very careful, a scrupulous process. Cells, our cells, yours and mine, have very careful mechanisms to be able to go back and check its work, to make repairs when there's a mistake made. And so the proteins that we get usually are accurate and you know exactly what was called for by the DNA. But reverse transcriptase, on the other hand, is a very lazy and sloppy enzyme, and it frequently makes mistakes, so that the DNA that comes here often has mutations. And occasionally the virus gets lucky, and the mutations are to the advantage of the virus. And some of those mutations eventually can develop in individuals and make the virus resistant to AZT, and now we know DDI and DDC as well. One other disadvantage of these drugs, as you correctly pointed out, is that they're all expensive. AZT runs about $10,000 a year, maybe $12,000 a year for individuals in this country. I think on the whole, there's some major justice issues having to do with how access to drugs is apportioned, not only in this country, but on a worldwide scale. In this country, it takes us about $100,000 to provide, on average, to provide the care for an HIV-infected individual per year. And it's obvious that that kind of money is nowhere near available to developing countries where, you know, 6/10 of the world's HIV-infected population lives. So that's a major problem, not just for these drugs, but for all their aspects. In an attempt to sort of get around some of the problems of these drugs, there are two things that have been tried. One is to try and combine the drugs together. The idea being that maybe mutations will develop less likely if we combine them together. That strategy has been used successfully in other kinds of infections, like tuberculosis, for example. And there's some indication that it may be helpful as well in HIV. The other strategy, or the second aspect of the biology of HIV that's important, is after reverse transcriptase was discovered, over a couple years after, other unique enzymes of this virus, unique proteins, began to become evident. One is an enzyme called protease, which the virus uses to kind of do its final packaging of proteins before it spits those proteins in a final virus particle out into the bloodstream so that it can infect another cell. So protease is important for the virus's ability to make new, sons and or new progeny, new virus progeny. And there are two other proteins, TAT and Rev, that the virus uses to sort of take out over the host cell's machinery and turn it to its own uses. And so these are also important proteins that the virus uses to accomplish its life cycle. And we now have drugs that are available that inhibit all three of these and are beginning early trials in human beings, have already been, tried extensively in test tubes and to some degree in animals when necessary and possible, and are now in early human trials. Protease is the protease inhibitor is the one that's farthest along, and we're going to be trying that in Seattle and several other countries relatively soon. It's already been tried in Great Britain. Seems to be promising. So perhaps by combining these drugs with these drugs, we will have a way to sort of turn this infection from something that is uniformly fatal, at least if you have AIDS, to an infection that people live with as sort of a chronic infection, more analogous to, say, diabetes or high blood pressure or some sort of very low-level type of cancer. Go ahead.
It's this sounds like I don't value human life, but it strikes me that all we're doing right now is lengthening the carriers' lives to possibly allow them to spread it more. With what we're doing right now, this is the impression I'm getting. With what you're able to do.
That's a good point. I mean, that's one perspective. I think it's fair to say, though, that although there are going to occasionally be individuals who are, going to be malevolently predisposed toward their fellow human beings, and will not be careful with their sexual behavior or with whatever other potential exposure they could put somebody in after they know that they are HIV infected. To a person, every one of my patients, and we've of course discussed this at length because this is I agree it's a major public health issue, to a person, every one of my patients is now sexually abstinent. Or if they're not completely sexually abstinent, they're very committed to safe sexual practices. They, you know, engage in, you know, mutual masturbation or other sort of non-contact sexual practices with their sex partner or partners. And so I think most individuals who are HIV infected, have realized that this is a life-changing, obviously, event for them. It puts them in contact with their mortality in a very stark and arresting way. It's this time bomb, this great sword hanging over their heads. And you have to be a fairly malignant individual before you wish that on someone else. And they realize what sort of danger they are to other individuals. So I think that's probably less of an issue than one might suppose. I think you can say that about a number of other human infections as well. I mean, sure. Perhaps maybe some things, there's a number of other things that fit into that category.
What in terms of total population, what's the percentage of deadly?
That's a good question. I meant to mention that worldwide, it's about 1 in 400. I tried to give that statistic at a staff meeting yesterday, and suggested that about half of those, or perhaps at Holden Village, there was one person, throughout the village that may be HIV infected. Actually, in the United States, the number is even more arresting than that. It's 1 in 250, roughly, that's infected in this country. And the interesting thing about it is, we didn't discuss some of the basic aspects of the infection very much, but HIV is most often asymptomatic. And so there's no way for you to tell whether I have HIV, whether I'm infected with the virus, by looking at me, and there's no way for me to tell whether you are. Most individuals with the virus, unless they have gone to the point of AIDS and fairly advanced AIDS, where their immune system is severely depressed, you can't tell by looking. There's no way, unless you have the copy of their antibody test report. So I think that this is a problem that's much more prevalent among us than we realize.
If it's 1 in 400 worldwide, mm-hmm. and 1 in 250 in the U.S., and so very prevalent in Africa, there must be areas where there are not very many. Mm-hmm. There's a much lower incidence.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Western Europe, although it had an epidemic that was similar to ours in terms of timing, has a lower prevalence per population. And at this point, in some other parts of the Western Hemisphere, although HIV is on the rise in Latin America, let's say, and to some degree in certain parts of South America, that's still a relatively untouched part of the world. It's relatively uncommon in the Soviet Union, although, of course, it's more common than they were willing to believe until Glasnost. There are a number of parts of the world. The United States sort of bore the first brunt of this infection, and that is changing now in recent years as the epidemic shifts to Africa and even more recently to other developing parts of the world.
What about China?
It's HIV infection has been reported from every country of the globe now. There's at least one case in every country of the globe. I think in China it's a relatively uncommon phenomenon as well, but part of the problem with China is it's difficult to get accurate health statistics. It's not something that they're likely to fess up to, too aggressive.
Everything that I've read says that because of this, the cost involved, that basically it's going to so overburden our medical system that the whole thing's going to break down, mm-hmm. that we will not be able to handle it, and in fact it will begin to affect our care of other things because so much financially, mm-hmm. The whole system will come to a halt. Is that accurate, and what do you see for the future? I mean, is there...
Well, I think in this country, that's probably as big an issue as one might suppose, partly because, as I said before, in this country, the epidemic is plateauing, and so we're going to continue, at least for the next foreseeable, you know, decade or so, have roughly the same number of individuals infected with the virus as we do now. So if it hasn't swamped our healthcare system already, I don't think it's going to. I think that our healthcare system is swamped of its own, you know, not counting HIV. That's actually a topic that I want to talk about next week when I talk about healthcare policy. But I think that probably HIV isn't the major contributor to that. Certainly, there are a number of high-ticket diseases that we have in this society, though, and HIV is one of them, but not by any means the only one. So I don't know. That's partly a matter of political and social perspective, I think. But
are we heading to a point where we will need to begin to make choices as to where we apply our care? And that's not just with this, but it's so expensive. Some of the treatments, and you start treating people maybe who are. Do you stop treating people older, for example, because they don't have the years left? I mean, that's one of the suggestions.
Yeah.
Younger people would get a disproportionate amount of care.
Yeah. Well, my answer to that, you know, the short answer is, yeah, I think we probably are going to have to make those decisions. I think we probably should have been already. But the criteria by which that we make those decisions, how we make those decisions, are still clearly up for grabs. And I think that's a long discussion that probably, you know, is not something that we can wrestle with right now in the next 5 or 10 minutes, but I certainly think that, yeah, we're going to need to make those decisions. I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards about that if you're not going to be around next week and you want to hear my perspective on it. Let's see. There are a couple other quick things that I wanted to talk about. I think what I'm going to do is jump to finally the vaccine, because people frequently ask me what is the possibility for getting an HIV vaccine. There's a protein on the surface of the virus called GP120, a highly technical name. It stands for glycoprotein or sugar protein number 120. Don't ask me why they named it that. but GP120 is the protein that helps the virus find its way to the helper lymphocytes, to the particular cells of the immune system that this virus targets and depresses. And it has been hypothesized, and now to some extent proven, that if you can give individuals through a vaccine, by injecting a vaccine into them, the GP120 portion of the virus without giving them the entire virus, if we can strip off the protein from the virus or artificially manufacture the protein independent of the rest of the virus and then give that to individuals, that their immune system will mount a good immune response and develop a memory, develop some strength and tone against that protein. And if the immune system develops strength against that protein, it will also be able to resist the introduction of a whole virus should somebody see it in the future. And so this strategy for vaccination has been tried. There have actually already been about 13 or 14 candidate vaccines that have been put through some sort of limited human trials. Two, or perhaps, depending how you count, three of them look like they may have some promise as first generation vaccines. Some of these trials have been done in Seattle. There are 5 centers in the United States where vaccines are being tested. And I work with the individuals that are doing the vaccine trials. And one of the things that I think is important to say about this is that the individuals that volunteer to test for testing these vaccines are true heroes of, you know, of humankind. Some of them I actually know, and a few of them are church members who have just basically decided this was something they could do. It's a potentially risky position to put oneself in, to sort of put your health and health safety at a little bit of risk to be taking a protein that nobody really knows what its effects are going to be or whether it's going to improve or decrease your chances of picking up the virus. But in fact, it turns out that a couple of these vaccines do seem to provide individuals with some immune protection against picking up the virus. And we're hopeful that in perhaps 2 to 3 years, we may be able to start large clinical studies, large population studies of these vaccines. Go ahead, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I thought she had a question.
I do have a question.
Oh, okay, George.
What can you recommend for those of us who are not infected from getting it?
Well, clearly right now, avoid these behaviors, and if you're heterosexual, or for that matter, if you're gay or bisexual, to practice safe sexual practices. Essentially what that means, I think, is being very careful with a new sexual partner, making sure that that you're using condoms and other forms of barrier protection so that body fluids aren't being intermingled. And then, you know, there's a lot to be said for this epidemic in monogamy. And you know, knowing who you're having sex with, and then knowing where they're at, and then sticking with them rather. So you know, I think that those are safe sexual practices that when I'm working in the sexually transmitted diseases clinic at the county hospital in Seattle, I am carefully telling every person that comes through, as are all individuals in this field, that those are the things that need to be done: safe sexual practices and being careful. But when you find a partner that's free of a sexually transmitted disease, including HIV, to consider sticking with them.
How is your blood transfusion?
Blood transfusions in this country I consider to be safe. I don't really have any, resolve and feel any necessity to stay away from a blood transfusion. Most blood banks do offer a service where you can provide yourself an auto transfusion if you're going into, say, elective surgery or something like that. You can come in a few weeks ahead of time, give a pint of blood, let your system have enough time to recoup that blood, and then you have your surgery. But truthfully, I don't think it's particularly necessary. I think that the blood supply is safe from an HIV standpoint. Cases from other sorts of bloodborne infections that we know to be existing in this country. In other parts of the world, that's not the case. But since 1985, we've had a test that's really a very reliable screening test for HIV, and every unit of blood that's drawn for donation in this country is screened. So the blood supply is extremely safe. I don't think there really hasn't been any known transmission of the virus since that time through blood transfusions. Primarily in this country, the 3% is in hemophiliacs, in individuals that needed preserved concentrated blood products because they had a bleeding disease. And that those individuals now are safe as well, but before the test became available, were at high risk.
Even now when you donate blood, they have these computer-coded labels where you say use or don't use the blood. That's in case you're giving blood under social pressure, mm-hmm. But you shouldn't be. But
yep.
You can code it to say don't use it.
That's right, so, yeah. That's sort of the first-line screening, and then after that, each unit of blood has the test as well. So go ahead.
How do you feel about having healthcare workers or doctors, nurses, HIV testing?
That is a large can of worms. I think there are a couple questions to that, or a couple answers to that. The first answer, I think, is that it's an extremely low risk to anybody to pick up HIV from their healthcare worker. Unfortunately, the cases of actual transmission, some people debate if there really are any, but supposedly there have been 5 from the Florida dentist. The data on that's not real conclusive, but it seems likely. Or the cases of potentially where there was a healthcare worker There was a physician in Minnesota, for example, who might have transmitted it, have been highly publicized, and I think that worry has been blown all out of proportion. You know, the risk of picking up HIV from your healthcare worker, from your doctor, your dentist, is roughly equivalent to that of having a meteor fall on your head. I mean, truthfully, that is the degree of risk that we're talking about here. And so I think the first answer to the question is that, you know, the politics of it have blown that risk so far out of proportion that it's completely ridiculous. I think the second answer, though, is that there are some appropriate precautions, which I think the CDC has, for the most part, and state health departments, have most part taken to reduce even that, you know, sort of meteoric risk. So I think one more question, then we're going to have to close.
I can't recall. I thought I saw this in one of the weekly magazines. A minority person whose son has AIDS was saying that he couldn't afford the expensive thing and medication, and people who had it all seemed sure to die, or something that the record that people did, but not everybody who hadn't had it, and so he wasn't going to touch it. He thought we were better off being poor. You want to?
Well, I think, you know, part of that mythology, if you will, comes from the fact that none of the three drugs that are presently approved, AZT, DDI, or DDC, are perfect drugs. None of them stop the virus cold. All of them statistically help, but you can find, you know, many, many cases of individuals who've been on these drugs who clearly have progressed and to AIDS and eventually have died. You can find hundreds of, you know, at least 100,000 of those cases. In addition, because, as we said initially, not everybody who has HIV goes on to AIDS, there are perhaps some people who have innate immune system tolerance or ability to ward off the virus. There are some individuals who are HIV positive that no matter how we treat them are going to continue to do well. Right now, we don't really have a very good way of figuring out who's who. And so it's true that there are a number of individuals who have not taken anything that continue to do very well. But overall, if you look at people in sort of a large, more statistical way, we think that the medications are advantageous. It's also true, though, that these medications have side effects, and some individuals just do not tolerate the side effects. So I think we're going to close now, but I'm available for questions and would be happy to talk to you, any of you individually. And in addition, invite you to come on back tomorrow, and hopefully we can do a little more sharing of experiences and perceptions on the social implications of this epidemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.